Welcome to the Spectator podcast. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. After another extraordinary week in politics, with Nigel Farage resigning as UKIP leader and Labour MPs trying still to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, the Conservatives are in the middle of choosing a new leader for their party and a Prime Minister for the country. Most Tory MPs are asking who should come next. But in their cover story for this week's magazine, Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth ask what should come next. It's time, they say, to make the Tories into the new Workers' Party and appeal to the Labour voters who backed Brexit and may be prepared to consider joining the Tories. They join me now, along with Matthew Paris, a columnist for The Spectator and The Times, who writes in this week's magazine that Brexit has made him feel ashamed to be British. So James, you said last week in the magazine that you felt the Tories had much in common in spite of the feuding. And what is this great unifying agenda that you and Fraser write about this week that will bring them back together?
Well, I think it's essentially social mobility and popular capitalism. It's understanding that the economy as it is today isn't working well enough for those, not just at the bottom, but those in the middle. But there is a sense, and if you're going to maintain support for kind of centre-right, free market, liberal economics, it has got to be a sense that the economy is working for everyone, and where it isn't, you have to be prepared to take steps to try and make sure that it does.
Now, David Cameron was mocked, Fraser, when he tried to do these sorts of things when he first started out as Conservative leader. How is this not a sort of wishy-washy shift to the sort of Notting Hill set who are interested in things like chocolate oranges?
It depends if you mean it. That's the big difference. I mean, lots of politicians say they want to help the poor. What we found out during the referendum campaign was that the words and the promises of politicians and indeed the various experts lined up to say Brexit will make you poorer were not heeded by people whose experience has taught them that the great economic progress they keep reading about isn't really happening in their community, in their neighbourhood. Right now, the Conservatives can do many things to actually help people. For example, if you're on low pay right now and you get tax credits, you can end up basically keeping only 10p of every extra pound that you earn. Now, David Cameron was railing against this 5 or 6 years ago. He can actually, you've got the possibility of changing that to make people actually feel better off. I mean, the Tories were very good in the coalition era, and the Lib Dems, I suppose I should say, of taking people from welfare into work. What they haven't been so good at is making work pay. So there can be a real, I think, recognition that globalisation, certainly that I was cheering on without any hesitation in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was a recognition that this has worked very well for people at the top, not so well for people at the bottom. And that if you're a free markets and conservative, as I am, you need to acknowledge the unequal effects of this and also acknowledge, which is quite difficult for conservatives, that government has a role, that laissez-faire is no longer the right answer. You need an active interventionist government to work at what's going wrong in our economy and to try to change it. You might argue that's a left-wing agenda. I wouldn't. I'd say it's the new conservatism.
This sounds quite Blairite to me.
I think a lot of what Tony Blair did was very good. I was a huge fan of his public service reforms. I was a huge fan of his of the general idea that the poor should have as much choice as the rich. I think Blair actually stole conservative clothes. He wasn't really a Labour chap, I don't think, which is why the Labour Party hasn't won a majority without him for a very long time and probably won't do for a very long time. So sure, you can say that this is an evolution of the reforms started by Tony Blair. Personally, I would not take that as an insult.
Matthew Paris, you're quite downbeat about the consequences of the referendum in your column, but would this new Conservative agenda cheer you up?
I sat down on a bench in St James Park outside the window here to read this new manifesto, and even on a hot July day, I was thrown back by the blast of hot air that hit me from the leading article. Defend the NHS, hooray! Help society's losers, hooray! More job security, hooray! People look to the nation state, hooray! Look at the issue of low pay, hooray! Address the generational imbalance, hooray! Radically simpler planning system, hooray! Abandon HS2, hooray! Schools reforms, hooray! It's the unprotected who understandably look to the government, hooray! Leaner, smarter, braver and more active government, hooray. Yeah, I mean, we're in favour of all those things. We could have done all those things before Brexit. Some of them are incompatible with some of the others, and what they are definitely not is an answer to the populist, nativist cry of rage which won Leave for the Brexit campaign.
Why aren't they?
Because what people want protecting from is competition from abroad, competition from foreign labour, competition from steel from China and things like that. People want tariffs. People want a populist agenda. I don't think we should give it to them because people are wrong.
But Matthew, certainly you and I disagree here about what Brexit was. I don't see it as a fit of nativist pique. I don't think this was saying the world is too big for us. I think people had basically were fed up with the EU, perhaps more broadly. They felt the system wasn't working to their advantage and this was a rare chance they could get. Many people who'd never voted before did vote in this because they thought it might actually change something. It might not have been a very reasoned critique of the EU itself, just a chance to change the record. It's the same thing I heard when I was covering the Scottish referendum. A lot of people there didn't really think that Scottish independence would be that good a thing in itself. It was just an opportunity to do something big, something drastic, and it was popular amongst the same sort of people who voted for Brexit. This is the same demographic that is causing trouble right around the Western world right now. The people who tend to be voting for Donald Trump in the US, the people who vote supporting populist parties in Europe. And I think their cry that this isn't working and that the mainstream politicians shouldn't pretend otherwise is something which needs to be heeded. It's difficult for the left because, yes, they do involve immigration in that. Now, personally, I'm a huge fan of immigration. There was a time a few years ago where I wanted to abolish all border controls and have a completely liberal country. But my mind was changed when John Cruddas took me to Dagenham and introduced me to BNP voters. He wanted to say that they weren't racist, they weren't proto-fascist, as we in the press were very keen to call them. They were people who felt they were being abandoned by the mainstream parties and that politics ought to recalibrate towards them. That, I think, was a very good point. And in Britain, we managed to crush the BNP. They were down by 99% at the last election. And it is by these sort of democratic shocks to our system, which Brexit was, that the priorities of the government can reorientate themselves towards those who are concerned, and we avoid exactly the kind of more vulgar, more sinister outbreaks that we see in the continent. I mean, there isn't a racist political party in Britain right now, and that's something a lot of other countries wish they could say.
Well, we could listen to people and address people's concerns and focus on what's worrying them until the cows come home. But as your leading article starts by saying, what are we going to do? I don't see anything here that we couldn't have done while we were in the European Union.
I think one of the things that historically we'll think of as odd is that we had the 2008 financial crisis, the crash, and we've had no reckoning since then. And I think that one of the things that did happen in this referendum is that for a certain type of voter, it turned into a reckoning for that. Now, that obviously is not purely to do with the European Union at all. I don't dispute that for a second. But I think we have been very bad at dealing with this sense of unfairness, this sense that, you know, the one industry that can get bailed out is the bankers, but, you know, don't think that you can help all these other industries. Now, you know, there is a challenge here about whether people see the system to be fair or not, or whether they see it to be rigged. And I think you need to do a lot more to promote disruption and innovation. You know, there are far too many vested interests in the private sector that successive governments, both Labour and Conservative, have stepped very gingerly around because they believe that they're too important to be annoyed, even when they fail, as they did in the financial crisis.
But James, why do the Conservatives really need to worry about having a new pitch to voters? Labour is in such a bigger mess than them that they could really propose anything and get elected back into government in 2020. Isn't that right?
I think that is broadly correct. I think the case for what you could call kind of whole nation conservatism would be that this is a chance to realign politics. You know, if you look at the two, I would argue, in the moments in post-war era, you know, 1945 Labour government and then the Thatcher government in 79. You can, if you take things on at the tide, you can reshape politics so that it moves in your direction for generations, so that you create a new settlement that both sides have to accept. And that's in this moment where, because the Labour Party is in disarray and because lots of things are up for grabs, because we've left the European Union, things are planning to leave the European Union, I should say, things that people previously would have thought were too difficult to do, I think there now might be the will to do.
Somewhere in the night, the Spectator has moved to my left and I have moved to the Spectator's right. We seem to have crossed paths. Yes, I mean, these are lovely ideas, but many of them can't be afforded.
Take planning, for example, yeah. Right? The successive governments have refused to do proper planning reform because they don't want to upset people who don't...
Our readers. They don't want to upset our readers.
I completely would accept this. It will not be popular amongst Conservative voters. I think there is actually now kind of moral imperative to build more houses because, A, the demographics aren't going to change. And it is unfair that if you basically happen to own an asset or inherit an asset, you're going to do so much better than people who are relying purely on their own income. It makes society much more rigid. I think one of the things is that there's obviously been economic benefit to building more houses. I wonder now if because of the economic disruption that will follow leaving the EU, there might now be the political will to do it that there never would have been before.
But I guess, Matthew, your criticism to James and I is all the things that we're listing are, if not quite political cliches, things that people have been saying for 10 or 15 years. Mm. And here we are presenting it as a brand new conservatism. In fact, these are the objectives that all parties reach for now and again when the promising of a new tomorrow of difficulty isn't delivering it. And what should make the Tory party change? What I think will force, I like to think, will force the party to change is this. That we saw after the Scottish referendum, if voters defy their party, the Labour Party, on an issue, as the Scots did in independence, they are there in the market. Somebody can come along and steal them. Nicola Sturgeon did that. She made an incredibly powerful follow-up to the referendum by saying to these voters, you know, leave the Labour Party and join the SNP. Now, right now, we see a third of the Labour Party voters who've backed Brexit, so they are already in the market. And you can see UKIP recalibrating, getting rid of its leader, thinking to itself, now is the time for us to transform into a party of the working class and to go into these areas that the Tories feel squeamish about, to make arguments the Tories might not because they're worried about upsetting their posh friends. Now, I'm a great believer in the Conservative coalition, something that can, which I think Thatcher managed to assemble. And she assembled it because there were certain people there, the Strivers, you might want to call them, who turned to Thatcher, who then turned to Blair, who didn't quite turn to David Cameron. And now it's not clear who they're going to turn to next. If the Labour Party is going to split, we read earlier this week that some of them are planning to form a sort of metropolitan party which disavows itself from the working class and their unfashionable views. That might well happen. But who is going to look after these voters? There's a massive opportunity for the Conservatives to make a pitch, using perhaps the language that Boris Johnson and Michael Gove used in the Brexit campaign. They managed to resonate with people who've been put off by the Tories for a long time. So I like to think that the scale of the opportunity will make the Tories reorientate and also acknowledge that if they don't, then UKIP will.
James, which of the three remaining candidates in the leadership contest do you think espouses these values the best?
I think that's a very good question. I think in terms of the radicalism of the moment, I think Michael Gove is more there than anybody else. I think in terms of who these voters might find as a reassuring figure, Theresa May is probably more there. I think the point is this, though, which is this vote, and I completely understand why people who support Britain's membership of the European Union are frustrated by this point, because the referendum turned into a referendum about something about far more than EU membership. It turned into a referendum on the status quo, the system, the failure to respond adequately to the financial crisis. All of these things is what it became a referendum on. But I think the point is the answer to this, if Britain is going to make a success, and it's by no means guaranteed it will, but if Britain is going to make a success of a post-Brexit world, there's got to be more radicalism, not less.
We're about to enter a period, perhaps a prolonged period, of intense anxiety, financial and economic instability. This is the last possible time in which to undertake radical reforms of the kind that you suggest. We just all need calming down a bit. I think Mrs. May will do that.
Fraser?
I'm wondering, Matthew, I mean, do you think that the Conservative Party is in fear of splitting? Because normally in a leadership crisis, you have the wets versus the dries, the modern artists versus the traditionalists. It's difficult to work out who the two opposing camps are now, isn't it?
It's always difficult because there are so many cross-cutting alliances, but were there to be a general election now, and heaven preserve us from such a thing, the Conservative Party would split because about a third of it would be unable to sign up to a manifesto for leaving the European Union.
Well, to the extent where they would rather vote for the Labour Party than vote for a Brexit Conservative Party.
I think they would form a separate group within the party that had to dissent from the manifesto.
Depends on the extent to which you think Brexit is a done deal, that the referendum will result in that. And I can get that people were deeply divided over this, but when you set aside the divisions over Brexit, surely the Conservatives are now more united now than ideologically than they've been for a very long time. But the right of the Tory party didn't really have a candidate other than Liam Fox, who was knocked out at the first round. And they all seem to be talking about the same kind of things.
Yes, you are right there. There is a convergence around this new modern... It's a sort of John Major conservatism, really, and I'm glad we're coming back to it.
So perhaps, Matthew, we should say that you were right all along and that... But the thing is...
Of course, we can always say that.
That was Fraser Nelson, James Forsyth and Matthew Paris. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that our podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.